Welcome to the Kindling's Muse podcast.
Hi, this is Dick Staub with another in our Journeys series, conversations with thoughtful creatives and cultural influencers on their life, work, and personal journey. This is Dick Staub back with you. We're visiting with Randy Olson. He is the filmmaker who made Flock of Dodos, an exploration of the contemporary controversy over evolution and intelligent design. We were just talking about Michael Behe and the comparison or contrast that Randy's drawing between Behe and Stephen Gould. Having said that, though, there were some scientists in your film that said that there are some interesting questions being raised by intelligent design folks. And one of the things that I think you do well in showing the poker game of the Harvard elite scientific community is the degree to which they haven't even really engaged in the debate at a certain level. And so kind of when you look at intelligent design, what are some of the things that it has raised that are worth considering within the scientific community?
I think that one of the most fundamental, simple questions they do address, and right, it is a fascinating question, is how does evolution and how does natural selection really work down at this microscopic level and at this cellular level and at this molecular level? And there is so much complexity going on inside of an organism and a cell, and the examples that we have of natural selection are relatively simple, of birds eating moths and things like that, and right. It does seem like a pretty big leap from there down to this finer scale. But that's no reason to just throw up your hands and say, we're going to draw the conclusion that we'll never explain this, which is what they do.
What is his – talk a bit about the mousetrap illustration and the Mount Rushmore illustration, because they appear more than once in this film, and they are easily understood. And one of your points is that they have intelligent design movement has taken easily understood kind of images and metaphors and has distributed them kind of prep sheets to mere mortals who are kind of the soldiers going out in everyday life and communicating. What's the mousetrap illustration and what's the Rushmore illustration?
Well, let's start with the Rushmore illustration, which is the idea that we can detect the presence of a designer at work. And so what they talk about, they like to draw these analogies of other professions which are design detection professions, such as arson investigation. You go to a burned down building, you try and figure out, did a human cause this or was it an accident of wires just, fraying? And forensics is another example. You see a dead body and then you try to figure out, was this an accident, did a tree branch fall on this person, or did somebody actually come, was it homicide? They draw those little parallels and say that we routinely are looking for the presence of a designer at work and these sorts of things. But the problem is that when you're doing that, you have hypotheses. You're using a scientific process because we know we've seen a lot of dead bodies that are the result of human actions. And so we know what a gunshot wound looks like. Now, here's the fascinating thing. If you took a forensics investigator 1,000 years ago or something like that, or 2,000 years before the advent of gunpowder, and given them a body that had been shot by somebody with a gun, they'd never know that that was human caused because they wouldn't have an eye for what a bullet hole looks like. So it's a function of what you have for your previous experience, which you use to then construct a hypothesis, which you then test.
Right.
And that's how you do the arson investigation. That's the scientific process. That's how a gas station mechanic fixes your car. Something's rattling in your car and they come up with four or five hypotheses that they then set about, okay, I'm going to look under this thing and figure it's that or this or that. There's nothing that special and unique about the scientific process. It's just that process of reasoning. And the problem is that they talk about whether life is designed or not. And where do you get the data to draw that with? Where have we ever discovered designed and non-designed life before? We've looked at lots of bodies that have been killed by a person and not killed by a person. So we got right. The data to construct those things. We've never discovered life before. If we went to 10 other planets and found 5 of them where the life was designed and 5 where it wasn't,
right.
Then we'd have the data that we then could come back to planet Earth and say, okay, now we know what design looks like and not.
What you're talking about is an untestable hypothesis.
That's it, exactly.
And the issue with an untestable hypothesis from some people in the intelligent design movement would it ought to at the very least bring some level of humility to the scientific community. There are questions that can't be answered through the scientific process. And so, I've talked to a lot of scientists who defer on the issue of kind of theistic questions and the famous quote back in the, I interviewed the guy and his name just flipped out of my head about George Smoot, the hand of seeing the fingers of God, and the scientific community was up in arms because he used the word God. And he said, look, this is a kind of an
a previous question. I right. can't answer it scientifically.
Right.
We ought to admit that as scientists. And that's kind of where I think the common sense population comes into the picture. They seem to understand this more than the scientific community does. And so the scientific community belittles public common sense in the way they approach this issue. Real quickly, talk about the mousetrap illustration, though, because it's a simple illustration, and it does kind of, well, talk about what irreducible complexity is and how the mousetrap illustrates it.
Irreducible complexity.
He's about ready to fall into the pool. Let's take a closer look at it.
Exactly. Irreducible complexity is the idea that some structures are just so complex that they could not have gradually evolved step by step over time. And first off, it brings with it this assumption that is a naive assumption that they make, that Stephen Jay Gould, I'm sure if he were still around, would be incensed to hear them say that, which is that everything is gradual in these evolutionary processes. When in fact, one of his entire life's theses was punctuated equilibrium, the idea.
Big, massive change in short periods of time.
Exactly. Yeah. Things that can happen very quickly. And when you look at these growth fields and the way in which development portions of embryos induce other portions, you see there's multi-level interactions, and it almost kind of comes down to the butterfly effect. You know, one little flap of a butterfly wing can change everything in the entire picture. Change can happen so rapidly, and I think that's also what infuriates a lot of evolutionary biologists. They've watched these sorts of minor changes in, you know, a single base pair changing in a DNA in a chromosome and seeing it have huge effects within a species. And then to have somebody come along and say, well, you know, you can only get so much change. They're just putting a limit on what they think we can understand. So getting back to the mousetrap, that is meant to be an example of irreducible complexity. And the idea is that a mousetrap is made up of a bunch of these different parts.
A platform.
And the trap and the bar that holds it down. And you remove any one of those pieces
and the whole thing doesn't work.
It's not functional. Exactly. And therefore, they believe that it had to have arisen all at once like that. And a good comparison type of thing is the idea of looking at a stoneway arch. You look at an arch like that, and if you remove one piece out of that arch, the whole thing collapses, and you could come to the conclusion about, well, then no one could ever build an arch other than just having it instantly appear like that because, you know, it doesn't hold together. But that's because you don't know that you can have scaffolding as you build it together.
Wouldn't it be healthy to have that conversation? Wouldn't it be healthy for a scientist, an evolutionist, to sit down with an intelligent design person and talk about that and discuss it? I mean, isn't the part of the problem the ships passing in the night?
It is apples and oranges. It's a major disconnect and divide. And part of the problem is because this is turning into faith and belief when you simply believe that evolution is not powerful enough to explain all the diversity of life on Earth. And how do you argue with people about their faith and beliefs? That's what it turns into, is you're arguing with the person.
Well, but the illustration you just gave was a logical approach. It wasn't a faith question. It was, look, you know, you're saying that there's this irreducible complexity in a mousetrap, but what about an arch? And so it's really a logical argument. And I think there is kind of an assumption, it seems like, in the scientific community, that the population isn't capable of understanding the logical arguments, and that's one of the things we want to get to. One of the things that you do is you show that over here in this corner, you talk about a boxing match, you have the intelligent design movement, which is well organized, well funded, has kind of cheerful, positive American people that we could relate to. And then it used to be over in this corner, you had, you know, Carl Sagan, or you had Stephen Gould, who were popularizers. They were academics who could speak language that was interesting and entertaining and engaging to the public, so they could kind of represent to the public. You know, as you were talking earlier, I was thinking of the importance of what's happening in the academy and the assumption in the academy that it's going to trickle down to the public, when in reality there's always been a need for middle brow characters who could translate academic higher level thinking to everyday people who would step up. But to do that, the academy has to step down. And what you said is Gould could do that, okay? Or at least he had a compelling ability.
He was somewhat.
You also talk about him talking really fast, and how smart you are, you couldn't hang on. But your point is, who's the advocates on the evolutionist side? And you take us to a poker game. We're going to pick up with the poker game in just a minute. And that was a really interesting part of Flock of the Dodos. We'll be back with Randy Olson, who is the filmmaker who made Flock of Dodos, right after this. Don't go away.
Join us for our next podcast. Thank you for listening to Journeys on the Kindling's Muse.